Before your presence, if you will, open up your New Testaments to Luke, the 9th chapter. Tonight, Dana DeGarmo is going to begin a series that Ross and he will be working on. Probably got my grammar wrong and all of that, but we're going to be studying the book of Romans. Dana approached Ross and I about that 2 or 3 months ago, and so we've been working toward that. And so Dana's going to start tonight. We'll do one lesson a month in that, and we'll rotate through the three of us. So look forward to one of the elders. I know all the elders can get behind the pulpit and preach, but I think it's important to see the shepherds deliver the Word of God. I think that's one of the things that is very needed in all congregations. And glad that Dana approached us about that and is willing to do that. So I hope you'll come back tonight and be a part of that. Ross is, of course, in a gospel meeting today over in Rockdale. I hope you'll have the chance to go and encourage those brethren. It just goes through Tuesday night, so you only have a couple of shots to be involved in that, but I hope you will. And keep me in your prayers. I'll leave later today for a meeting. I'll be gone the rest of the week. Luke, the 9th chapter, is an interesting time in Jesus' life. It is a full with miracles that happen, the feeding of the 5,000. But the confession that begins with Peter acknowledging who Jesus is, and then Jesus talking about his death, what was about to take place. All of this precedes what we want to study this morning, the transfiguration of Jesus. Beginning at verse 28, read with me down through verse 36. Now about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure. The English Standard renders that, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. And as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. Well, we listen to someone's voice in life, don't we? It doesn't matter who you are influenced by somebody. We may describe ourselves politically as being conservative or liberal or moderate, but we are going to be receiving then whoever we are listening to that influences us. It may be CNBC on one end and Fox News on the other, but we're going to listen to the voices of people who we believe are telling us the way things are, the reality of things are. It may be sports to you. It may not be politics. It may be money. It may be guys like Warren Buffett. It could be a great many things that we're talking about, but we listen to the voices of people that are around us. What we need to hear most of all is what God will say in the voice of the cloud, that this is my beloved Son, hear him. Matthew and Mark both record this incident also. Mark in chapter 9, as Luke is chapter 9, Matthew in chapter 17. They each tell us a bit of the story that is a little different. So if you want to read later today, you can see some of those things. Matthew and Mark both say, as they begin theirs, now after 6 days. It is Luke that says, about 8 days after, these sayings. And so we are wanting to ask, what does he mean by that? What sayings? Well, if you back up with me, let's go all the way up to verse 18. That as Luke records what he is saying, he is pointing out after these sayings, these things that he writes earlier in the chapter. Now, it happened that he was praying alone. The disciples were with him, and he asked them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others the one of the prophets of old has risen." Then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." Already, as we think about that statement, there are voices claiming all kinds of things about Jesus. Some were saying, "You are John the Baptist that has come back from the dead. Elijah, or one of the great prophets." You remember Jeremiah was thrown into that mix in the other two accounts. "One of the great prophets of the Old Testament has arisen." But he said, of all those voices, what voice matters? Who do you say that I am? And you remember that on the other occasions he said, "It is God my Father that has revealed this unto you, Simon." In other words, when he says these things, they believed what God had sent Jesus to teach about himself. And verse 21 goes on to say, "He strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one." Then he said this to them, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised." Imagine if you were to go back in time and put yourself in their sandals, as it were, and listen to Jesus as you saw all of these great miracles. He had just fed the 5,000. He has done unbelievable other things. People could come up and merely touch the robe of his garment. The power would flow out of him to heal all kinds of things that they suffered from. He had cast out demons time and again, many of them crying out, "We know who you are. You are the only begotten of the Father." But he would make them, in effect, shut up and not make known who he was. They had seen all of these wonderful things that they would have attached to the kingdom and to what they would have called glory. But can you imagine listening, knowing that that's what they've seen, and now all of a sudden hear him say, "I'm going to Jerusalem, I will suffer, the elders of our nation and the chief priests are going to kill me, but I will rise on the third day." Can you imagine how confused they would be? In fact, one of the accounts says they talked among themselves, "What does he mean by this rising from the dead?" They could not have ever, when Peter confessed, "You are the Messiah, you are the one promised in the Old Testament, the Christ of God, we believe that." They could have never seen the connection to that and the humiliating death that he was about to die on the cross. Then he says, verse 23, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." Folks, when we hear the word cross, as often you have probably heard in sermons, people dangle it around their necks in all kinds of jewelry in our day, from their ears and from all kinds of paintings. It doesn't mean the same thing to us as it would have meant when they heard that word. It was the most brutal form of execution and punishment that Rome gave to the greatest enemies they would have considered to their state, whether they were common thieves and criminals or those especially that rebelled against Rome. It was slaves and others that died by this manner, not any Roman citizen. A Roman citizen could not be put to death by the cross. And so when he had said in verse 22 that they are going to kill me, he didn't identify how. But don't you know, they must have somewhat thought, why does he bring the idea of a cross into this conversation? And that we have to take up our cross daily and follow him. To go on with the reading, "For whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed," listen to him closely, "when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." So Jesus promised that there would be people, if you are not ashamed of him, if you are one that confesses him and follows him, that he will come in his glory and the glory of the Father. And then the very next episode is he takes those three inner disciples with him, Peter, James, and John, and they go to that mountain, and all of a sudden his appearance is altered. You can imagine what they believed about that. This is that glory. This is what we know the Messiah would be. And everything about that would speak to what they wanted to hear. Peter's grand confession that they all believe the Messiah is Jesus Christ, was about to be shattered when they would witness the horrors of what was about to happen in Jerusalem, a cross of shame and the degradation, humiliation, and the violent death. In fact, in Matthew's account, Peter had rebuked Jesus when he talked about dying. "Far be it from you," he said, that this should happen to you. But in the sight of this Mount of Transfiguration, that same Peter is going to say, "Lord, this is great. Is it good to be here? Let's build 3 memorials on this place and hang here for a while and bask in the glory." Matthew tells us, and so does Mark, that he was transfigured before them. Now Matthew obviously, and Luke says, they were asleep. That they had to be heavy. So he had prayed obviously for apparently a long time and they had gone to sleep, and they all of a sudden wake up to this incident and have to come fully awake before they realize the other two people that are going to enter this scene are with Jesus and conversing with Him. And apparently Peter and all of them can overhear it. Somehow they knew that was Moses and they knew that was Elijah, because Peter says that when he wants to build the tents or tabernacles to them. Peter's confession was, as we said, the revelation of the Father. But the Mount of Transfiguration is God saying, "Come and learn what true glory is." Because He is going to give them a glimpse of the victorious Lord. What they're going to have to witness when He goes to Jerusalem is going to shake them to the core of everything they are, and could shake us. If we were in their same place, or if we were to be persecuted in our day for following Him, persecuted to the extent that we lose our possessions, that we are put behind bars, and that eventually some of us are put to death, we could be shaken to our core that this is not the victorious Jesus we signed up for. That we believe that He will protect us and provide for us and give us all manner of things that He has promised to do upon this earth for us. But those things are true not only for them in the first century, it is true for us as well. The Transfiguration spoke, I think, to them in more than one way. I want us to think about this in terms of four V's, actually. I used to do 3 V's, but I thought of a fourth that's important. The first is the vision. As He prayed, do you ever think about what it was Jesus was praying about so earnestly? They had gone to sleep, apparently, because He had prayed so long. We don't know, we don't hear, but in light of all that we have just read before this, do you think He's on His mind is the cross? Do you think on His mind what is coming up in Jerusalem that He must endure, and He must endure for the sake of those 3 men that are with Him and all the others that are alive then and will have died before and will come after? That what He is about to accomplish is the meaning of all that God put in place when He created mankind. The word says He is transfigured before them. It is the Greek word metamorpho. You hear our word metamorphosis. The other day, one of our hanging baskets, I found this huge caterpillar. It looked like one of those kind that get on your tomato vines, but not quite. It was a little bit different. Of course, I immediately, when I see things like that, take it to Wilma, just so I can hear her scream. But I said, you know, I'm going to put this in a bottle. I want to see what kind of a butterfly it turns into, or a moth, whichever the case may be. I wasn't successful. I'll just go ahead and tell you it expired on me. But I did my best. I fed it the same stuff it was on, and it had eaten all of it up on one occasion, but I don't know what happened on the second occasion. But be that as it may, had it changed? As you often do when you go to these butterfly houses, you're always amazed by looking at those cocoons, those chrysalis that they weave and web, and then this thing that would cause you to scream, cause my wife to scream because it's so hideously ugly, metamorphoses into something as beautiful as a monarch butterfly or a tiger tail or whatever else you were looking at. You can't imagine the change between this thing that's so creepy crawly to this thing that is so unbelievably, iridescently beautiful in its colors. That word transfigured means, meta means a cross, and the other word means its form is changed. The word form there, morphe, can mean, we use that word, we say it morphs into something else in that same way.
It means the true essence of something. It's used in Philippians 2 to describe that Jesus was in the form of a slave, and also it says He was in the form of God. He was both. His essence was that that's what He came to do, to be a servant to everyone else, and He always was God. He could not change that part of Him. So what happens on this occasion is they look at Jesus, who looks like just anyone else in this world. He's just a man to them. But for a brief second, He is metamorphosed. He is changed across to that glory that He had with the Father before He came. And how does it describe that glory? Matthew 17 verse 2 says, His face shone like the sun. His clothes became white as light. Have you ever tried to not look at the sun, and burn your retina, but look as close as you can sometimes to the brilliance of light, to where it hurts. You get so close, it you can't go any further, and the blindingness of that. Try to picture that is what is going on. Mark says in chapter 9 verse 3, His clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them, the English Standard says. Others say could not whiten them. The best launderer you know could not make them that brilliantly white as those guys woke up and saw when they looked toward Jesus. And so Peter, many years later, would write these words, chapter 1, verse 16 and 17 of his second epistle, "For we did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of His majesty. For He received from God the Father," he's talking back to this very incident we've read of, "For He received from God the Father honor and glory," our word, "when such a voice came to Him from the excellent glory," the New King James translates it, "This is My beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." The word that Peter uses there is a word, megaleotes, and it has a word mega in it that you hear big as we think of. And the other part of it is the word that translates glory, majesty, magnificence, mighty power. Those are different words that are used by translators in the other four times it is used, or counting this one, four times that it is used in the New Testament. This magnificence, its mighty power, its majesty, that we cannot even begin to describe God. Why God would not allow anything to be made in His image. How are you going to equal God to something on this earth that you would bow down to? Make Him a bull, a golden bull, with wings and all the splendor that you could make of gold. It is to diminish God, is to make Him something far, far less than He is. The Bible describes Him in terms like this, and the times that He will reveal Himself sometimes, like on Mount Sinai, and when He came down on the tabernacle, on the Shekinah, the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And that cloud would overshadow Moses and when he'd go in to talk with God. And that it filled the temple, as we'll read that passage a little bit later in the lesson, when it filled the temple and drove out the priests, they could not perform their task when Solomon dedicated it. That's how God revealed Himself. You cannot describe Him. There's no way to capture the mighty power and majesty and might of this God. And so Peter refers to it as the excellent glory. In John the 17th chapter, if you'll turn over there with me for a second, I want to read the first part of this that I didn't put up on the overhead. When he begins his prayer, remember, to the Lord, he is with the disciples in the upper room, chapters 14, 15, and 16. He has been talking to them after he had washed their feet. And then at verse 17 it says, "When Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come." That characteristic word in the Gospel of John. This that all of that had ever been written before, everything that had been pointing to, this hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you. We sang that song this morning. And then verse 5, "And now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself with the glory which I had with you before the world was. That glory that cannot be manifested here, because were it to be manifested, it'd be the Mount of Transfiguration all the time. His son, his face like the sun, his garments so bright and brilliant white you could not look at him. Were God to manifest himself to us in the fullness of who he is, what did it say? It doesn't in Luke, but if you read Matthew and Mark's account, it says they were terrified, these men. In fact, that's the reason Peter, you know, bless his heart, says all the stuff he does sometimes. But on this occasion, he says, let's make three memorials, because he didn't know what to say. And one of the accounts says, because he was terrified. I mean, if God wanted to terrify us, he could do it. And we'd all be upon our faces, hiding our faces from him in the fullness of his glory. And so Jesus prays for that. Glorify me with the glory that I had with you before the world was. So what is this glory of Christ that he's going to have to go through this process now to obtain that again, as the Mount of Transfiguration gives us a glimpse? Other men have died for other men. Those boys that stormed the beaches on D-Day, sacrificed fully, knowing when those boats hit the shore what could happen to them and happen to many of them in the days that followed as they took back Europe from the Nazis. Many, many other accounts in history are like that. Brave men, but there is only one who, by dying for everyone else, saved us from our sins and redeemed us to the Father so that we would not have to die ourselves. The disciples said, you cannot die. The excellent glory said, no, Jesus is right. Listen to him. In the cross is glory. And there is glory no other place. The second thing that we need to see in this story are the visitors. I mean, if I were to think about two of the greatest people that I would want to meet in the Old Testament, those would be two. I can add to that Abraham and Joseph, maybe David, King David, a lot of others that I'd want to put on that list. But why these two? Well, I think immediately we understand that phrase that is used constantly, the law and the prophets. That Moses was the giver of the law and stands as the very cornerstone of who they were as a nation. He was the one that came and led them out of Egypt and into Mount Sinai to learn how to worship God, and then was to lead them to the promised land. And Elijah stands for all of those great prophets. In fact, when we read his story, you get that sense in the Old Testament. And even they understood why there is an Elijah that is to come. It had been promised by Malachi. In Matthew 17 and verse 10, they had asked that. Is John that? And John said, I am not. Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets, the most significant personages in the Old Testament, now come to converse with him. About what? Luke 9 and verse 31, go back with us and read, who appeared in glory, they are in His glory, as it will later say to us, who appeared in glory and spoke of His departure, the English Standard says, the New King James says, of His decease. It literally is the Greek word exodus. We spell it exodus in the Latin form. Exodus, exodus, to exit, to go out. These men now appear to him to talk about the very thing that had been preceding all of this up to the Mount of Transfiguration, that Jesus had told them, I'm going to Jerusalem to die. These men, Moses and Elijah, had left the world in a very unusual manner. God took Moses and buried him and hid his body, and nobody knows where that grave is. Elijah was caught up in the chariot of fire and carried into the heavens. Very unusual going outs when you think about other men that were as righteous as they were. But the going out of this third one, of Jesus, is all important. Wouldn't you have liked to know more about that conversation? Wouldn't you have liked to have listened in to what it must have been like for those two? And think about it. They are still Moses and Elijah on the other side. That's a wonderful story in itself. They are also conscious of what is going on. They know now more fully than they have ever known. And I don't know what point on that side, because it doesn't tell us that. But they are now talking to him about the very work that he is about to accomplish. G. Campbell Morgan says, what they said to him or he to them concerning the cross is not chronicle, but may it not have been that as he looked at them, he saw again the necessity of his cross. Did he not know that the perfecting of the just had been through the faith they had reposed in the purpose of God? Those Old Testament folks. And did he not know that the purpose in which he had had fellowship was that of redemption by blood? Did not these men say to him by their very presence, heaven as well as earth awaits thy cross. And unless thou dost pass from the mount of crowning to the mount of crucifixion, and I love this phrase, heaven must be unpeopled. For we are of the company of those who have died in faith, looking for Shiloh, our desire and our Redeemer. We wait amid the splendors of the upper world, and all is lost to us if thy work of redemption be unfinished. Moses and Elijah, when they woke up, they saw those men. The text says they saw His glory when they woke up. So it must be His glory that is foremost. And while all of this is going on, eventually those men are going to depart. So the question is, why? Why would they depart and leave Jesus? In fact, one of the accounts says that the men were terrified by the voice of the cloud. That voice, the glory that can only belong to one, is what the message of the cloud was saying. Elijah and Moses are no more. What they stood for, what their purposes were in the law and in the prophets have been brought to fruition in Jesus. That is exactly how the Hebrew author begins his book. By saying, He spoke to us in many ways and in different manners by the prophets in times past, but in these last days He has spoken to us through His Son. That His Son is the message that we must receive truth from. He is in the embodiment of all truth. They were the veil. They were the mere shadow of the thing that was true. And so it is that in His glory and in His glory alone, we are to rest. The cloud that we mentioned already. Peter, in verse 33, wants to make three memorials. He wants to bask in the glory of what is going on this occasion. But it is when the cloud comes over them. And can you imagine what that must have been like? They said they were terrified in one of their cases. They were on their faces to the ground when they entered that cloud. Luke says they were afraid when they entered it. In 2 Chronicles 7, 1 and 2, when Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from the heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. This very thing that Peter is describing, a voice came from this excellent glory. This cloud that had rested on the tabernacle by day and by night, this cloud that had also blessed the tabernacle when it was dedicated, now blesses the temple, and in that cloud is God's glory. The priest could not enter the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the Lord's house. Can you imagine what that would have been like? For all of a sudden, this cloud now again, that is mentioned so often in the Old Testament, to have come upon these men, and they to hear this voice boom to them. This is my beloved Son. Hear Him. You and I need that phrase as much as anyone. I think about Peter saying, not knowing what he said. You know, that's what I want to write on about 90% of what I turn to TV. If it's on Fox News or if it's on CNBC, I care not. Most of what people are saying, they don't have any idea of what is most important, what is absolutely vital. And if we miss that, we will have missed everything. So you want to make a monument to Christ and to Buddha and to Muhammad and one for Moses and Abraham and just go on down the list. This God that comes in the cloud and says, this is my beloved Son. Hear Him. The only glory is in the fact of what He will do upon the cross. And while there may have been messages of truth in Moses and in Abraham and in what they stood for and did, He that you are listening to is the truth and the way and the life. And so victory finally. 2 Peter 1, verse 17 that we read a moment ago says, He received from the Father, when this happened on the Mount of Transfiguration, He received from the Father honor and glory. Verse 26, if you'll back up in the text there, He says, For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father. There is a day coming. I don't think necessarily this incident means at the end of time. That will fit. But it will also fit when He is resurrected from the dead, when He is seated at the right hand of the throne of God and He rules and reigns in His glory. He is going to come then. He'll come at the destruction of Jerusalem. He will come in the judgment of the last day, and all of it is His glory. I love Peter because the only other time in the New Testament the word exodus is used is by Peter. When Peter wrote his epistle to them, he said in 2 Peter 1:15, we read that text from 16 down, but in 1 verse 15 he says, I'm writing these things to you that after my exodus. Moreover, I'll be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease. The New King James renders it. Is it a wonderful thought to think that in all that we do here, somebody said that this morning, I remember in a prayer in the class said, we're going to leave a lot of unfinished business here. We're not going to do well here. This world is set up to fail. But there, no. There, all we have done, if we serve God with all of our heart and soul and mind, as much as we may yet think at life, at the end of life, as I said to you about Brother Iverson, that he constantly said to me, he just didn't think he was worth much. He didn't think he had accomplished anything. Deep down, I think we all share that. But when we reach the other side, whatever small things we have done here, God has used to His infinite glory, to His infinite purposes, to accomplish His will upon this earth. When I exodus this life, as you will too, when death comes to us all, then listen to Alexander McLaren. It will be a true exodus. The going out of the slaves from the land of bondage and the passing through the divided sea, not into a weary wilderness, but into the light of the love and the blessedness of the land where our brother is king and where we shall share his reign. And such was, I think, Peter's thought as he was thinking of the end of his life. Jesus said, now what we must do is follow Him daily, taking up our cross. That if we would save our life now, we will lose it in that world to come. It will take everything out of us. We don't have any idea what He will demand of us. He looked at Peter and said, one day, Peter, people are going to take you where you do not want to go. Speaking of the manner of His death, John wrote, He can have that will for any one of us. But we rest in the certain fact that He is the one who was glorified by His death upon the cross and glorifies us together with Him in that age that is to come. Missionaries once were left on the islands of the Indonesia archipelago among the headhunters. The captain of that 18th century ship said to their leader, "You will all be killed." The missionary simply responded, "We died before we came." May we also understand that. You're subject to heaven's invitation. Jesus said, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned." If we can help you to do His will this morning, like Heather did earlier this week, we bid you come as together we stand and sing.